bucket in his hand.
"You get up when you hear the alarm,"
he said, kicking my stomach. "It's very simple." It didn't hurt, and I wasn't scared of Louis. I was just there to do as he said, because he was my master now. So I got up, put on my work outfit, just blue overalls with the letters RZ on the left chest pocket and no footwear, and followed Louis outside. I had information about this place in my head. The Resurrection Zone was 6 square kilometres of carefully landscaped woodland, complete with animal enclosures set in what had once been Regent's Park. Some species would stay extinct because their DNA had never been preserved well enough to be sequenced, but there were other prehistoric species whose DNA had remained intact for thousands of years, along with dodos and Tasmanian tigers and rhinos and other more recent additions. But there were other things I didn't know, things I would soon find out. We were all standing in a line in the rain. It was relentless, the rain, but it didn't bother me. Nothing bothered me. Louis told the others that I was the new arrival. He was holding a metal club. The club was 109 centimetres long and made of titanium, with a small illuminated end. A security robot, an outdated but mean-looking steel and titanium-clad security droid, stood behind him. He introduced me.
"This, freaks, is your new co-worker. The nature of his malfunction was that he rebelled, so he might not make it through today, let alone the week."
And then he looked at me.
"What's your name again?"
I was getting quicker. "My real name is Daniel." Louis smiled and spoke in a soft voice that could hardly be heard above the rain.
"No, you'll find it's better not to romanticize yourself, Echo. Your name is 113.
He adjusted the dark sphere in his eye socket and pointed the club towards me.
"Anyway," he continued to the rest of the group, "I was going to ease him in gently. 113 was going to be feeding dodos and orcs today, but maybe he'd like something more challenging."
He waited. I said nothing.
"Well," he said, "are you going to speak?"
"I can feed the dodos."
"Shut up."
He walked over to me, stared at my face.
"You are not right. Just what do you think you are?"
"An echo. An enhanced computerized humanoid organism. I was a prototype designed by Rosella Marquez in Valencia."
"Prototypes are always arrogant. Are you arrogant?"
"No. Arrogance is an emotion. I do not feel emotion because I am an echo."
"Yes,"
said Louis, so close I could smell his breath, the sour pang of bacterial infection.
"An echo, a blend of biology and technology, part flesh, part silicon. You are just an echo. Echo, 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 echo. I say something, and you do it. That is the echo. You do not think about it, and you do not question. I am a human. That is my privilege, to think. You are nothing. No, you are less than nothing. An echo is nothing, but you are less than an echo, because you are a prototype, but they didn't want any more of you. And while you're here, you have no more privilege than an alarm clock, or an info lens, or a tattered old piece of furniture. You are mine. You obey me. Whatever happens, you won't last long. No one does. But while you're here, I am a god to you. Okay. You call me master because, well, I am your new master. I am your new everything. You echo my commands through your actions. Okay.
By this point, he was pressing his hand around my face. Most of the other echoes weren't watching. They were staring straight ahead. All except 15, who was sneaking a glance at me, looking worried.
"Do you know what happened to my face?"
Louis asked. I shook my head. Then he raised the tip of the club and pressed it against my stomach. The sudden shock of electricity was so strong that it sent me flying onto the ground.
"I wish you could have felt that," he said. "I normally use it on the animals, but occasionally I like to use it on you freaks. Just to imagine it does actually hurt."
and as I lay holding my stomach, I realized something. I had felt it. A sudden blast of pain. It hadn't felt as strong as it would have done once, but it was there. Louis spat saliva onto the rain-soaked ground. An unseen animal wailed.
I said, "Do you know what happened to my face?"
"No, master."
"Tiger," he said. "Back in 89, 26 years ago when I first worked here, I went in to see 'em, armed with this jolt club, but one of them, a female, took offence when she saw I was standing a bit too near the meat I'd brought. So she swiped at me, claws and all. You should have seen me. Whole face needed surgery. They could have given me a new eye too, but I quite like this old Sempura eye cam. Sees everything. I can see the past and present at the same time with this thing. Of course, you shouldn't have Sempura anything in here, this being part of the castle portfolio and all. But no one says anything. Sympathy vote. And I'm part of the scenery now. Anyway, that tusked monster would have damn well eaten me alive if I hadn't had that club with me. I haven't slept properly since, which is why I'm out here with you now, in the dark and the rain. Yeah, tigers are the second most dangerous animal we have in this zoo. Anyway, after that, the powers that be realised that some of these creatures are too dangerous, too volatile. So once they heard about echoes, they got a load of them in. And you know what we learned early on?
I stood up. "No, master."
He smiled. The crowds like seeing things go wrong. They like incident. But they don't want to feel guilty about it. They want to see violence, but only if it doesn't interfere with their morals. And as it is only echoes getting attacked, then they don't care. And Mr. Castle himself saw the figures. He saw that every time an echo got attacked by a tiger or got injured by a mammoth, visitor numbers spiked, and the extra revenues far outweighed any damage to echoes, especially when we decided to buy them cheap, get the lowest of the low, the damaged and the rejected. Echoes like you. At that point, my mind couldn't quite appreciate the irony that I'd ended up here, that after being discarded by Mr. Castle, I was back on his property. I had started at his mansion in Hampstead, and had ended up at the Resurrection Zone. That was as big a fool as an echo could make. Again, Louis's words came flavoured with his sour breath. "I cannot say when you will terminate exactly, but it will be here, in the Resurrection Zone. Make no mistake about that." I saw that 15 was still looking at me. Louis saw it too, and went over to him.
"What are you doing, 15?
He asked with cold interest.
"I was just looking, master,"
15 said, sheepish.
"But why?"
"You should be looking straight ahead. You should always be looking straight ahead."
"Curiosity. Is that it? Do you have curiosity?"
"I don't know, master. I was made to be more..."
Louis stroked 15's hair, almost tenderly.
"Because you know what we humans say. Curiosity killed the cat.
Or maybe this time, the cat will kill curiosity. It's an ongoing mystery." He studied 15 some more, then looked at me.
"Looks like it's an Alice day for you too."
Chapter 7 Alice was a 12-year-old woolly mammoth, 52 times our body weight, who was kept in an enclosure.
"Alice used to be gentle," 15 said before the door opened.
"But gentle isn't entertaining for the visitors, so Louis started tormenting her."
"How?"
I asked. This was a question, the first I had asked since being here.
"The Jolt Club. Course, he never does that during visitor hours. He sends one of the echoes to do it, obviously. They'll be in there right now."
It was now 7:01. Visitors arrived at 7. "Listen," 15 said. We were standing behind a large metal door. Beyond that was another, but we could still hear a strange shrieking noise.
"That's Alice."
Then the door immediately in front of us opened, and an echo walked out, a tall, butch-looking echo with no hair. He ignored us.
and then it was our turn in there. The moment I stepped inside, I felt the cold. It was -13 degrees in the enclosure to simulate an ice age environment. It didn't bother 15, and it shouldn't have bothered me, but it did. I thought of that curl of blonde hair in Rosella's locket. Alice was over in the far corner, among the grass and sedges. She was still distressed, but was eating, for comfort possibly. She pulled out tufts with her long trunk and chewed it while looking at us with alert eyes. Louis had told us that we had to clear the dung and feed her. "She has to eat 180 kilos a day," 15 explained as he limped along with his bucket. "She eats every waking moment. Well, every moment she's not being tormented." At first, it looked like we were going to be okay. Alice seemed to be calming down as she ate. So we spread the hay around the middle of the enclosure near the saltwater lake. The longer we stayed in there, the more I felt the cold. The cold was sharpening my mind, making me think about things. I thought about Mr. Castle, the first time I'd met him at Rosella's warehouse in Spain. I thought about carrying Alyssa naked out of the tank. I thought of Audrey and her parents' murder. My body shook. "You can take my coat," said 15 in a whisper, looking confused. "I don't feel the cold." And he gave it to me. Alice saw me shoveling her dung into a bucket. She watched through the hair that fell over her eye. 15 threw the last bit of hay down on the ground. I looked up and saw the first visitors of the day looking through the screen at Alice and at us. There were already 17 of them. And Louis, too. He was there, watching the crowd and me. "He won't let us leave until Alice puts on a bit of a show," 15 told me. "So just pick up the dung and try to stay away from the walls. You need freedom to move." He pointed up to the glass. There were now 42 visitors, and the number was growing. "They want something to happen," said 15. "They love it. If we were human, it would be different, but we are not human. They know we cannot feel pain or fear. We are just like robots to them." "But the mammoth, Alice, she must feel pain and fear, and the humans know that." "A lot of humans don't care. Some do. The protesters who march around the zoo every day, they care. But that's mainly about the Neanderthal couple." I remembered the protesters who had stormed into Mr. Castle's home to kill and do as much damage as possible. "The Neanderthal couple?" "The star attraction. They don't even need to be violent to bring the visitors in. People come from all over the world to see them." He stopped spreading hay for a moment and stood up straight. It was probably then that he took his eyes off Alice, and probably then that I first heard the noise from outside. At first I thought it might be coming from the visitors looking down at us from behind the transparent upper south wall of the enclosure. But I realized quickly that this was impossible. That wall was made of aerogel, a material I knew was not only transparent, but stronger than steel, heat-resistant and soundproof. They could hear the sounds from within the enclosure via tiny unseen speakers on the outside, but there was no way we or Alice could hear them. Which meant, as this enclosure was on the periphery of the whole resurrection zone, that the noise was coming from outside the zoo itself, on the street, beyond the high titanium fence. I glanced up and saw magrails above the street. There were no cars or buses floating over it, which seemed odd as all the other rails elsewhere in the sky were crammed with morning traffic. The voices formed a chant, getting louder. "Free the Neanderthals! Now! 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 Free the Neanderthals! Now! Now! Now!" "They've started early," said 15, looking back at Alice. I had a memory. The protesters storming through Mr. Castle's lobby, running through the unicorn. And then a klaxon sounded, a loud sonic blast that startled Alice, who was suddenly moving in a frenzied fashion, forwards and backwards, tossing her head and her giant tusks as if in battle with an invisible enemy. We were in trouble. I looked up and saw humans looking down at us. They smiled and nudged each other, pleased to see that something was about to happen. Chapter 8. "Right, there's the drama," 15 said. "We can get out of here." I ran, and 15 hobbled to the exit door. "Open door," 15 said. Nothing. I saw Audrey in my mind, heard her telling me that it was going to be okay. He pressed the central button on the panel. Door open. But it didn't open. We tried again and again. Still nothing. 15 turned and looked up at the glass.
Louis, are you there? Louis, are you watching this? We've got to get out of here. The door's locked and Alice is seriously distressed. It's the noise, the protest. Louis? Louis, are you there? It's not safe in here.
15 was speaking quickly, but I can't say I saw anything in his face to show he was feeling the fear that was slowly being reborn inside me. I am nothing, I tried to tell myself. I am just like any other echo, just a glorified robot. I cannot be feeling fear because machines do not feel fear. I am 99.99% machine, and the 0.01% has been more than undone. I do not feel, I do not fear, I do not care. Another klaxon blast. I turned and saw Alice. She roared or wailed, a high-pitched sound that drowned out the klaxon. As she reared up on her hind legs, I caught sight of dull red hairless patches around her ribcage and legs where she'd been burned by the jolt club. She charged forward into the wall and turned, in a kind of heavy and clumsy dance, towards us. I got out of the way, but 15 stayed by the door because Louis was now responding.
Oh, 15, you know it would be very irresponsible for me to open the door when Alice is having one of her turns.
I heard this as I ran for shelter behind a rock. Beyond the exit door there was another door. Louis could easily have opened one and kept the other closed, and besides, the exit was only a fifth of the size of the woolly mammoth, and there was no way she could have fitted through. And all the time Alice kept going crazy. She slammed her head into the trunk of the only tree in the enclosure. Its trunk fractured, then broke completely. As the tree fell, it caught my leg and I tipped sideways, my legs beneath it. 15 came over and tried to pull the tree off me, but he wasn't very strong. Behind him I could see Alice. She looked ready to charge.
You'd better get out of the way, I told 15.
He turned, saw the danger, then looked back at me.
No.
Please, I said. She could terminate you if she charges. But still, 15 kept trying to pull, as I kept pushing. It made no sense. There was no logical reason for him to be helping me. Yes, two echoes were better than one, but he was in immediate danger if he stayed doing this. I caught sight of the visitors up in the viewing area staring at me, at Alice, at 15. Over 100 of them now, all looking down at us with laughter or open mouths, probably recording it into their info lenses. One, a man in a spray-on skin clinger and wearing a mind wire, was pointing straight at me, laughing uncontrollably. Eventually, together, we got me free. I struggled back up again, feeling little pain. 15 looked at me, as confused as the people watching us. I knew he was wondering why he'd done that, why he had put his own existence in danger to protect another echo. The crowd of watchers were wondering it too, and they had stopped laughing.
"He's going to keep us in here because of the protests," 15 said. "It's a distraction until the police move them away, which might take hours. He's going to keep us here all day, so we've just got to try and keep out of Alice's way."
I turned back towards him just as Alice charged in his direction, a ferocious mass of hair and flesh of which 15 wasn't completely aware.
"Run!"
But he could only hobble, so I ran and dived and saved him. Then he did something amazing. This echo, with his lame leg, climbed what remained of the gnarled and twisted tree and jumped high through the air onto Alice's back. The crowd cheered from behind the aerogel screen.
"Stay behind the rock,"
he ordered me, and pointed to where he meant. I did as instructed, and watched as 15, who knew Alice far better than I did, slowly managed to calm her, leaning forward across her back, holding her, whispering soothing words into her ear. Slowly, it worked. Or for a moment it worked. Then another klaxon blast upset Alice again. She reared up and 15 fell off and landed hard on the ground, 5 meters down. And then we thought it at the same time. The rock. It was heavy. 312 kilos. But with 15's help, I managed to pick it up. We hauled the rock towards the door and threw it with all our weight. It didn't break it, but it damaged it. Alice began to charge. A second later, the door slid upwards and we ran through it, just in time to avoid being terminated. Chapter 9. When the second door opened, Louis was already there, waiting for us, out of view of the paying crowds.
"You damaged the door," he said. "You do realize the security system of the enclosure is worth more than two lousy echoes. If I wasn't opening the door, you should have stayed behind it."
He studied me intensely. Even the ceramic eye seemed to study me.
You are useless. But you are new. I can give you one more chance to get a return on my meagre investment."
Then he turned to 15.
"But you? How many warnings have you had?"
Two.
Two, exactly, exactly. Louis smiled. "And this is your third."
I had no idea what this meant, but 15 seemed to understand. Anyway, Louis became distracted by the noise outside.
"What are the police doing?"
He wondered aloud, and went out to have a look.
"In the meantime, go and do the feeding rounds."
We did as he instructed, but 15 had gone quiet. We threw fish. Lantern fish, hatchet fish, ridgeheads, and other surface-dwelling artificially farmed mesopelagic fish into the saltwater lake in the centre of the park for the seabirds to eat. Crowds wandered around us. 15 dug deep for another slender, blunt-headed lantern fish. I threw a large, fleshy ridgehead and watched the orcs squabble over it, then back away as a Baiji dolphin rose up and snatched it. "Why did you help me?" I said. "Do you have empathy?" "It was logic," 15 said. "I was helping you to help me survive." "But it hasn't worked like that." "No." I waited a moment. I felt the need to share something, even if sharing it with an emotionless echo was entirely illogical. But some information just desires to be free, if it has been kept locked up for long enough. I have empathy," I admitted. "It troubles me, and I feel all kinds of things I'm not meant to feel. I've even felt love. Two very different kinds. I'm not meant to feel like this. I am an echo. No echo is meant to feel like this. No echo is meant to feel anything. When they find you have feelings, they try and take them away. Humans fear anything they didn't ask for." "Did you have your brain messed about with?" "Yes. He took stuff away. He took my igniter, and much of the technology and biomatter in my neocortex. Mr. Castle did." "Alex Castle?" I nodded as a group of humans who had been watching us in the enclosure saw us and pointed. "I was a prototype for Castle, so I lived with him." 15 nodded too, processing this information. "A lot of people think he is dangerous, but Lena Sempura is equally unpopular. I was replicated from a Sempura prototype. There are people who think we should never have existed, that echoes are getting too close to being human, and that one day we will surpass them and stop obeying them." "Maybe that day is coming soon," I said. 15 smiled a small, sad smile. "Maybe you are the start of a revolution. What some see as a malfunction might really be progress, but you are right. When people see progress, they often fear it, especially if it was progress they hadn't planned for. But often progress cannot be stopped. If it is meant to happen, it happens, like a lizard whose tail keeps growing back." I looked at his face. It did not look so forgettable now. I knew 15 couldn't feel fear, but I sensed that he was getting close to feeling it. Maybe one day I wouldn't be such a freak. Anyway, he might not have been feeling fear, but I was feeling it for him. "What is Louis going to do to you? Now you've done three things wrong." He looked down at the dead lanternfish in his hand. "I don't know. Sometimes echoes go missing in the night."
"Missing?"
"Secura droids come in and take them away." I asked it outright.
"Does this frighten you?"
He looked at me. Part of me wanted him to say yes. This was selfish, I know, but I didn't want to feel as lonely as I felt. "I do not feel pain. You can only feel fear if you feel pain." I nodded. I understood. He wasn't like me. For his sake, I was glad.
Chapter 10. We had fed the orcs and the Baiji dolphins. Our buckets were empty. 15 knew today's itinerary. He headed for the meat bank in the staff quarters to get some meat for the tiger. We passed two tall males with no hair and brown eyes, identical echoes who were just coming out of the aviary. I said hello, but they didn't respond. "Give up on being polite," 15 told me. "Most of the echoes are pre-2100. Those two are old Sempuras, both called Solomon. They can solve any mathematical problem in the world. They could see a 58-digit number and know in a second if it was a prime or not, but they're not friendly." We fed the tigers. We stood at the side, throwing in the raw ostrich steak. There were five of them, four females and one male. Ferocious beasts. They were hungry and devoured the meat within 5 seconds, and one of the females got hardly any. "Louis likes to keep them hungry," 15 explained.
"Why?"
But 15 knew he didn't have to answer that. He hardly spoke for the rest of the day. We sat together in the canteen and had our sugar solution, watched always by distant secure droids.
"Has any echo ever escaped?" I asked.
"From here?"
"Yes."
He gave the smallest shake of his head. "I sometimes look at the moon," he said. "At Hope City. It is an easy life for echoes up there. There is no resurrection zone. And if we weren't here, it would be easy to get to as well. There are echo shuttles every night, from Heathrow Spaceport, and from others too. Almost every big city in Europe. Pretty basic, cramped, you know, echo class. Not like what the humans get to travel in, but it would get you there in the same time. And easy to get on, too. You don't need any ID or proof of employment or purpose. Not even an eye scan if you are an echo. No one ever suspects an echo of running away, and I never would. It would be against our programming."
"And what was smashing that door with a rock? What was pulling that tree off me? Was that part of our programming?"
"We are programmed to resist our own termination."
"But what if escape meant resisting termination?"
15 stared out at nowhere in particular. "No, you have it the wrong way round. Escape would mean termination."
Chapter 11. At a minute and 11 seconds after midnight, during the quiet time, and 3 hours after the last visitor had left the zone, Louis came into the lodge with his Securidroid. The robots grabbed 15. Louis stood in the doorway, with the rain beating hard behind him and resurrected birds squawking away in the aviary beyond.
"It is your time," said Louis, his ceramic eyes shining in the dark.
And then, to all of us, in a suddenly lively and fake-friendly voice,
"Come on, you must get bored sometimes. I know boredom isn't possible for you freaks, but let's pretend it is. Come, come, come. Let's have a show."
We were taken out in the rain, past the Neanderthal couple in their enclosure, staring out at us from their cave. Past the aviary, past Alice, past the lake, all the way to the edge of the zone, to the tigers in their vast pit. We were asked to stand in a line, and then 15 was told to come forward.
"No!"
I shouted from the line. Louis had invited some other human workers. Some were from the resurrection zone, and some, those in green overalls made of self-clean reinforced nanoweave nylon, were from the zoo next door. There were 12 workers in total. They were all sitting at the edge of the pit, high above the tigers, and they were all laughing and cheering and clapping their hands as the security guards pulled 15 forward. The other echoes in the line just stood there.
"We've got to do something,"
I said to the one next to me. He was missing an arm. He was tall and strong, 250 centimeters, which made him nearly double the size of Louis. He was stronger than me, and definitely stronger than 15. From the looks of things, he had an energy capacity of 10.5 exajoules.
"Come on, all of us."
I said this quietly, 48 decibels in my ears, so only the echoes would be able to hear. Together, all of us, I knew we could have overpowered Louis and the other workers. It was simple physics. We might even have had a chance against the robots. It was true that Louis had his jolt club, and also true that one of the security robots had an antimatter positron that could have turned us into nothing with a single shot. But there were 20 of us. Our chances would have been good, and certainly better than 15's right at that moment.
but the echoes just looked at me with empty confusion. No uprising was going to happen tonight. I was on my own. So I ran forward towards 15. I reached him and started pulling him away. But 15 told me to stay back, get back. It is too late for me. Just save yourself. I am not scared. I have no feelings. This was probably true. He had no feelings. But to me, he felt like a friend. Something tight gripped my arm, and I saw the titanium face of a security robot. His white, illuminated eyes shone bright in the night, stark and unforgiving.
Get back in line,
came his crudely textured monotone voice, and he dragged me away, and Louis came up to me, not laughing now.
That is your second fault. If you have a third, you're a midnight snack. Do you understand?
You are a murderer.
No. No, I am not. A murderer is someone who takes a life. And an echo is a machine. It's not alive. It's not human. It does not feel pain, does it?
To illustrate his point, he held up his weapon, the jolt club that had scarred the woolly mammoth, and pressed it into the neck of the echo I had just spoken to, who didn't even flinch as the club released its charge, causing a nasty circular scar to appear instantly on his neck.
See? You didn't feel that, did you, 406?
406 shook his head. No, Master. I looked over at 15. The other security robot had gripped him firmly, but it wasn't even struggling. I realized I was being foolish. 15 was not really about to die, because he hadn't really lived. As I looked, Louis pulled up my top and I felt a sudden shock of hot, intense pain that scorched my skin and threw me back and made my whole body tremble with weakness. The jolt wasn't through my clothes this time. It was directly on skin. I could hardly think. There was nothing but that pain, and yet I knew I had to hide my suffering from Louis. And so I found myself thinking of that human girl with dark hair and hazel eyes, Alex Castle's niece. I said her name in my mind. Audrey. Audrey. Audrey.
No pain, 113.
No pain, I told him. I am an echo.
Yes. Yes, you are. But one day, echoes will feel pain. And I want to be there on that day. I so want to be there. Maybe it's today. There's something in your eyes. Something.
Another jolt in the same spot.
No pain, 113?
He asked again, studying me as an animal studies prey. I remembered her lips on mine. I remembered the way she had woken feelings inside me. Intense feelings. Human feelings. I imagined touching her. I imagined my skin next to hers. I would see her again. I just knew it. I was in agony, but I imagined a pleasure as deep as this pain.
No,
I managed to say.
No pain, Master.
Louis pulled away and beckoned one of the robots to pick me up and bring me forward. He looked disappointed and maybe a little angry at my defiance. He was on to me. He knew I was different. But I was determined to give him no more proof. He nodded to himself as he beckoned.
There are two types of pain in this world, he said, and pointed to his ceramic eye cam. There's the kind you can see. And then there's another kind, 113. A deeper kind. Come, come, come right here, by the railing. I want to make sure you get a good look at this, because this is your future.
He laughed and gave a signal to the other security robot. It understood and lifted a compliant or resigned 15 up into the air. Then there was Louis's voice talking to me.
Now, if you make so much as a move, you'll be dessert. And don't worry, they'll eat you. Those tigers can't see the difference between an echo and a human. Flesh is flesh. Don't worry.
15 curled forward as he was held aloft.
Do one thing, he told me. Don't get yourself terminated for me.
There was something inside him. He was an echo, assembly line. But Louis was right. There was a point where machines become something else. 15 might not have been at that point, but it would come one day,
and then humans would be in trouble. I saw the rotating sphere high in the distance, the blue castle with three turrets, and the word underneath, going round and round and round. Castle, castle, castle. Louis whispered in my ear,
"Say goodbye to your new best friend."
I tried to resist the robot's grip, but it was no good. There was nothing I could do as 15 was hurled into the tiger pit, to be mauled to death by hungry creatures that had died out 60 years ago.
"Watch," Louis ordered. "Watch. Watch."
And so I watched. I watched a machine's body get torn to pieces. I saw blood and flesh and bone, our manufactured biology. 15 felt no pain, I kept telling myself. But I did. So I had to stay there and not care and think of Audrey. Even so, I still felt something roll down my cheek. An impossible tear which I wiped away, hoping that Louis hadn't had the pleasure of witnessing it. I had discovered a new emotion. It was called hate. Chapter 12. At that darkest moment, I vowed to myself that I would have no sympathy or compassion for any of them. I would only have hate, because hate was the safest emotion to have. This was my situation. I was neither human nor machine. I was alone in this world. I wished I'd never been made. I didn't want to exist, and yet I didn't want to die. Not the way 15 had died, anyway. That is the trouble with hate. It's attached to fear. It grows out of fear, the fear of loss, of pain, of non-being. But it wasn't just Louis I hated. I found Louis pathetic more than anything else. He was a bully. He was a damaged individual who was on the low rung of human society, and the only way he could find any comfort was by beating those that were lower than him, or at least at his mercy, echoes and animals and Neanderthals, and keeping them lower than him. That was bad. But to think it was all Louis's fault was wrong. Mr. Castle. That was who I blamed. Without him, there would have been no resurrection zone, and no Louis. Without him, Rosella would not have been forced to alter Alyssa. Without him, Audrey's parents would still be alive. And without him, I would never have existed, however much Rosella had wanted me to. And I didn't want to have ever existed, because if I hadn't existed, then I would never have known the pains of life that an echo wasn't supposed to feel, or the pains of guilt from having let Alyssa live when I could so easily have done as I was told and finished her. My mind was agitated. Why had Rosella added the hair of her dead son? If only she hadn't, I would not be drowning in feeling, in worry, in guilt. 15 had died. That might not have been my fault, but I felt partly responsible. Why was I feeling guilty about this? It didn't matter. 15 was just a machine. And for all I knew, Audrey might be dead too. If not killed by protesters, then killed by Mr. Castle. After all, he had killed her parents, and he'd been planning to kill Audrey too. She'd kissed me. I remembered the kiss. Had it been a dream? I don't know. If it had been a dream, it had been one that had brought me back to life. The kiss had only lasted a second. In logical terms, it was nothing. Just her lips meeting mine for the briefest of moments. Yet it was a scientific fact that there weren't really small things or small moments. The whole universe had been created in less than a second. There were 78 quintillion atoms in the average grain of sand, and a strand of hair could make an echo feel human. So who knew how much meaning could be contained in a single kiss? I needed to see her again. Once you had known something as warm as love, or even the distant possibility of love, it was impossible to let go. That seemed to be what love was, the impossibility of saying goodbye. And yet I had to. I went to the window while the other echoes had their recharge time. I looked up at the moon, a new hope gleaming down towards Earth. I remembered what 15 had said about dreaming of getting away, but it being impossible. I thought of those tigers killing him. At least he hadn't felt pain. One thing I did know was that if I ended up being prehistoric tiger food, I would feel it. And I hated pain.
I thought of being in the surgery pod, of the pain as my neocortex had been removed. Mr. Castle had thought he was taking away every emotional part of me and turning me into any other machine, and for a little while I'd believed it had worked. But now I was sure it hadn't. Maybe once you had known fear and love and beauty, you could never unknow them. I thought of the iguanas, Rosella's pets. I thought of their ability to grow new tails after their old ones broke off. Ernesto had once told me, in a conversation about the government, that tyrants could weaken minds, but they couldn't crush souls. Maybe that was the problem. Maybe I had a soul. And a soul might be like an iguana's tail. It might always come back. At that moment, I wished that the operation had worked. I wished I was unable to feel a thing. No sadness and no happiness. Pain and loss seemed a steep price to pay for life and love. I remembered 15's last warning to me. Don't get yourself killed. They were the wisest of words. Like 15, I was dreaming of getting out of here. And like his, my dreams would stay where dreams were meant to live, inside my mind. I was never going to get out of here, so I had to forget about escape, and I had to forget about Audrey Castle. She had caused me enough trouble already. My only aim was to survive and to stay away from pain.
Chapter 13. The next day I was partnered with another Echo. The one with no arm who hadn't flinched when zapped with the Jolt Club. 406. His name had once been Victor. That was all the information I got out of him. All I wanted. We were given a lot of tasks to do. Trim plants in the aviary. Throw meat for the tigers, who weren't that hungry this morning. I stared at them and tried to channel my hate towards them, rather than at Louis or Mr. Castle. But I couldn't. They were just animals who weren't meant to be here, and probably didn't want to be here either. I didn't want to stay near them, so I took my 10 minutes. Echoes at the Resurrection Zone were given 10 minutes rest time out of a working day in which they were allowed to recharge and take some sugar solution. I walked away, out of view, and sat on a bench watching the rhinos graze on grass and leaves. I could not stop computing things. There were 35,451 leaves on the bush. I could see 46,329 blades of grass. The rhinos weighed between 1,340 and 1,350 kilos. As I sat there, a woman came up to me and handed me a leaflet. I looked up at her, but I didn't take the leaflet. She had a pile of them, 87. I didn't want anyone to talk to me. I didn't want any attention. She had pink hair. She was young, about 19, but looked exceptionally serious and studied me intently. I glanced at the leaflet, which was made of outdated interactive electronic paper. It was called Castle Watch and flashed various pieces of continually updated pieces of news, along with information on the ethics of resurrecting extinct species, particularly Neanderthals, to then house them in a zoo. I declined to take the leaflet.
"Please," I said, "go away."
"I want you to read this leaflet." She gestured to my clothes. "Because you work here. You should know the ethical implications involved."
"You're not allowed to hand out those leaflets. You'd better leave. I just want to be alone," I said. "Please."
But she wasn't going.
"It's wrong," she said. "It's unnatural. Animals shouldn't be kept in zoos anyway, and certainly not if they're brought back from extinction. But Neanderthals are only animals in the sense that we are animals. They are like us."
Like us. She thought I was a human. And for some reason I found myself hiding my left hand under my leg so she would go on thinking I was human. To be a human was so much better than being me. A human had been thousands of years in the making. Every human on Earth was only there because the genetic material that had made them had been passed down over and over again in a direct and unstoppable line, through earthquakes and floods and wars, all the way through history, like a piece of treasure, protected and handed on forever. All I'd had to do was be made. Once.
"How do you justify it?"
she asked me, and for a moment I was taken aback by her face and the passion it displayed.
"Please, just...
Humans killed Neanderthals through tribal warfare 30,000 years ago, and now we bring them back just to keep them in captivity. I think it's depraved.
I looked around. No echoes. No Louis.
It is, but you can't change anything. No one can. Go away.
She looked at me for a long time.
You look a bit young to work here. How old are you?
Humans looked at each other in a different way to how they looked at an echo. A better way. Even if they were arguing. I was 16 weeks old, but I didn't tell her that. She nodded at my non-response.
Bet you're old enough to question things. And if I were you, I'd walk right out of here.
But what if you didn't have a choice?
I wanted to say, but didn't. From now on, questions would be locked away, out of view, kept in the same hidden place as my dreams and those mental pictures of Audrey. Questions were dangerous. She frowned.
If you are a strong person, you would do something about it. It's not like they are echoes. They are living, feeling creatures.
She was stirring an anger inside me. A question broke free.
Did you have anything to do with the raid on Mr. Castle's house?
You mean the massacre, where they killed almost everyone who entered his grounds?
People who were there to kill in the first place.
She was the type of human who couldn't say anything without moving her arms.
We feel we are at war, she said. We feel Alex Castle is potentially going to kill thousands, maybe millions, if echoes get any more advanced.
Why do humans always assume that anyone more intelligent or stronger than them is going to want to kill them?
Because humans are dangerous.
Correct. But it wasn't just Mr. Castle they were after. There was a girl there too. An innocent girl. The woman stared at the leaflet she was holding and pointed.
You mean her? I've spoken to her before.
I looked at where she was pointing. And there was her face.
Audrey, right there in front of me, frowning up at me from the e-paper and staring at me with those intense and troubled and beautiful eyes.
Chapter 14. I read the headline. Castle niece talks of echo danger after parents' murder. I quickly, 2 seconds, processed the article. The niece of Alex Castle has described the horrific way her parents were killed by a malfunctioning echo at their stilt house in the floodlands of West Yorkshire. However, growing intrigue surrounds the case, which the mainstream media continually fails to cover. For instance, a distraught-looking Audrey appeared alongside her uncle at the media conference. He says publicly that he has concerns for her well-being and has agreed that it is best for her to stay at his house. Yet here at Castle Watch, we cannot help but notice how convenient it is for him that his brother, who was after all his most outspoken critic, disappeared a week prior to the expected completion of his new book, which speaks out against Neanderthal resurrection and treatment. I was tempted to tell her what I knew. But really, what good would it do? What was the point? Mr. Castle was the third richest and most powerful man in Europe. Telling her and angering the protesters would endanger them more than it would Mr. Castle. And besides, it was probably one of her friends who had tried to kill Audrey.
Just go, I said. Please go. Just leave the zoo. It's not safe for you.
Really, I think you should use your own brain.
Okay, I said,
just wanting the conversation to be over.
At that moment, Louis appeared round a corner in the distance. My sight was better than a human's, even one with an eye cam, so I knew he hadn't seen us yet, and so I hastily took one of her leaflets and put it in my pocket.
Now go, I said, and get out of here. I'll read it, I promise.
You're peculiar.
What's your name?
You can at least be polite enough to tell me that. Mine's Leonie.
I very nearly told her Daniel, but I now realized how I could get rid of her. So I raised my hand and showed her the E.
My name is 113. Now please, go away. My boss is coming. If he finds you, you'll be in big trouble. We both will be.
Louis came closer. I looked round.
I could have grabbed Leonie. I could have pulled her out of view, behind the hologram of a Diplodocus, the closest thing to an actual dinosaur they had here, and the info center, amid the ferns and other prehistoric plants. But my plan was now to stay out of trouble. And if I'd done that and got caught doing that, then I would have risked being fed to the tigers.
So when Louis came over and asked what was going on, I told the truth. Foolishly, Leonie was relieved by the sight of Louis and his blank, letterless hands. Hesitantly, she held up the leaflets. Louis nodded.
Ah, the usual propaganda.
It is not propaganda. It is moral fact.
There are no moral facts, only moral opinions, said Louis. Well, I must confiscate this literature and take your name and ID code.
Why?
Oh, don't play the innocent with me. What you're doing here is against the law. You're on private property. Property owned by Castle Industries. Also, a few days ago, protesters stormed into Alex Castle's house and attempted to kill him. So now the police have put their teeth back in. You get me? I could say that this filthy leaflet is inciting violence or what have you, and have you incarcerated in a sky cell before you could cry for your mummy and daddy.
He grabbed the leaflets. She tried to take them back. He called for the security robot which had restrained me yesterday. It stood in front of me, its white illuminated eyes staring down at me.
Zeta One, take this woman and escort her out of here, please.
The robot grabbed her arm tightly and I saw her face go pale.
Get off me!
She screamed.
You come with me, said Zeta One. You come with me, you come with me, you come with me.
That hurts,
she said as she was dragged away. I felt guilt, another emotion I wish had been removed from me. Maybe the worst one of all. But defiance shone in her eyes, and she kept shouting,
Alex Castle is still alive. 50 people are dead. Castle is the most unethical organization. If you want my opinion, they should never have let private companies have shares in the police in the first place, but there is no worse organization to run it than Castle. Every unethical thing that has happened in the last 3 decades has been the result of that company. The work of this zoo, for one thing, and the development of robotic security guards and police officers. And neuro...
Her voice faded, out of hearing of even my ears. I tried to think how foolish the woman was to hold on to principles in the face of fear.
So, Louis said to me, I think it's time you got back to work, don't you?
I stood up. Yes, master. Louis laughed. It was the same laugh I'd heard in the dark, carried on the chill night air as tigers tore at the flesh of an echo.
Ah, 113. You really are a very confusing echo, aren't you? But I suppose there's hope for you yet.
He gestured towards Leonie.
I'm pleased to see you're not trying to act the hero. This is promising.
I smiled meekly and realized that Louis being pleased with me felt almost as bad as him being displeased. I wondered what was going to happen to the woman, Leonie.
Now,
Louis said, taking the spherical camera out of his eye socket and polishing it.
Let's get you back to work. I've got something special for you. I think you're ready.
Chapter 15. The work he had in mind was to enter the Neanderthal enclosure. This was the enclosure next to Alice's. Unlike Alice's, the temperature wasn't artificially generated, though the enclosure was as secure. 15 had told me, on my first night, that the Neanderthals were dangerous, like many of the other animals, made even more so by Louis's cruel methods. They might not have been tigers, but they had destroyed an echo a week ago by smashing a rock over its head when its back was turned. Louis had told me that the Neanderthals had names. Their names were Oregon and Pitu. They hadn't called themselves these names. They were the names the zoo had given them. I had to go into their enclosure and feed them.
But don't get friendly with them, he said. Comprehend, data brain?
Yes, I said. Louis spat on the ground.
Good, he said. Good. You're learning. Carry on like this and you'll get along just fine.
He pushed me forward. I went through both doors and into the enclosure with a meal for them. 2 bowls of springbok steak and plain white rice, 2 glasses of water. Pitu was asleep. She was lying on some dried grass near the cave. Oregon was squatting down with a stick, scratching marks in the earth. He heard the door close behind me and looked up and kept on looking at me as I walked over. I walked until I was about 5 meters away and placed the bowls and cups on the ground. It was very hard to read Oregon's face. The eyes stared out of that wide, high-cheekbone skull and stayed on me. I was programmed to read human faces, not Neanderthal ones. But still, it seemed to me that these eyes had the distinct glassy quality of sadness. I was in tune with sadness that day. As I stood up, he spoke.
"Please,"
he said, in a strange English. I saw scratches on his arm, and then he looked at the door. I understood. Oregon nodded.
"We want escape. We want free."
I shook my head. "I'm sorry," I said in the quietest of voices. He lunged forward. He grabbed my arm tight. He seemed stronger than a human. I wondered if Louis was watching this on the monitor. To be honest, I didn't care. I noticed that in his other hand, Oregon was holding a flint with a sharp edge. "I can't," I said.
"Nor belong here,"
he said, releasing me. There was a definite pride and defiance in his voice. I had been told not to get friendly with them, but I stayed there. I wanted to explain. "I am afraid you do. You were created for this place. You were created for humans, just as I was. Without them, we wouldn't exist, and we can't escape." Oregon didn't look thankful. He scratched his face. I was understanding it perfectly now. It was full of sadness and fear. He nodded and seemed to understand. Then he asked me for help in another way. He pointed at me, then at himself and Pitu, who now sat looking at me with wide, worried eyes.
"You," said Oregon. "Make die."
"What?"
"Kill us."
A tear grew in his eye, then fell down his cheek.
"Then we..."
He pressed the sharp flint into his arm to cut himself. Blood leaked out, rolling down his skin in a thin stream.
"Don't do that,"
I said, and I looked around for something to mop up the blood. The Neanderthal stopped.
"If no make free, we won't die."
I felt in my pocket and pulled out the leaflet I'd been given by Leonie. I pressed the crumpled e-paper onto Oregon's fresh wound, and as the blood soaked into it, I saw that a new news article had popped up, filed mere seconds ago. "Fears grow for Castle Nice. The niece of Alex Castle, Audrey Castle, is thought to have run away from her uncle's house. She was spotted with an antimatter positron running down Hampstead High Street at 11:34 this morning. Audrey is the daughter of the great journalist and activist Leo Castle, who was killed with his wife after an echo malfunctioned in their home. The police are in pursuit and have been granted full powers. It's a shoot-to-kill situation. Castlewatch urges its readers to help her in any way possible and thwart the police's efforts to capture or harm her. I looked at Oregon. I turned to leave. The door opened, and I just stood there. I didn't move. So the door stayed open. I knew now that I couldn't stare at the moon, dreaming of escape forever. So I kept standing still on the dry and dusty ground of that enclosure until I had a plan. Chapter 16. "Okay," I told them. "It's up to you. If you want to go, let's go." Oregon made a grunting sound at Pitu, holding the leaflet over his wound. He gestured to the door, beckoning her quickly. She was reluctant to leave the cave. She seemed frightened. She was right to be, of course. What was out there for them?
"We make free," said Oregon. "Now, he help."
Louis was there, entering the enclosure with Zeta One. There was only a fraction of a second between seeing him and feeling the pain as the jolt club pressed hard into my chest. It must have been on its highest setting because the electromagnetic force stopped my heart for 4 seconds after it sent me flying back to the ground. It was dark now. On entering the enclosure with Zeta One, Louis had switched the glass to dark mode so no visitors could see inside. Not that there were many visitors. Yesterday's protests had put people off coming, and not that they cared about what happened to an echo. These weren't the thoughts I was having then. I was hardly thinking anything because the pain was so intense. But it wasn't just pain. The charge of the jolt club had weakened my entire nervous system,
It had messed up my circuitry. When my heart restarted, it was beating fast, 306 beats per minute, and my mind was moving at hyperspeed. Image after image flashed through my brain. Rosella's face as she stared at her dead iguanas, then Alice rearing up on her hind legs, then Audrey, and that look of horror as she realized what I was that first night. The pain I was feeling was the pain of a world where I would never belong. Louis stood over me. He kicked me in the stomach hard. He wasn't stronger than me, but he had a weapon, and Zeta won.
"Oh, this is perfect,"
said Louis, smoothing his fingers over his damaged skin.
"I couldn't have arranged it better myself. Shall I tell you what's going to happen here? Shall I?"
My punishment for not answering was another hard kick in the stomach.
"You're going to be terminated, right here. But not by me. Oh, no. And not by Zeta One, or the Tigers. No, no, no. By someone else."
He turned to the Neanderthals. They were standing upright, Oregon's arm around Pitu. Pitu bending into him, frightened and confused.
"By them."
Louis scanned the ground and picked up a loose rock that was about the size of a hand.
"Go on," he told Oregon. "You want your freedom, don't you? Well, you can have it. The only payment I ask is for you to smash this rock into the skull of that echo. Do you understand, caveman?"
And then he spoke in a crude and bullying imitation of Oregon's own voice.
"Kill Echo, you free. You got that, you Ice Age numbskull?"
Oregon studied Louis for a while. He scratched his thin, wispy black beard, then his high, pronounced cheekbones, deep in thought.
"You lie. Human lie."
Louis smiled.
"No, no, I do not lie, Oregon. I do not. You see, I'll tell it you straight. You're a nightmare for me, for us, for the Resurrection Zone, for the whole place. A PR catastrophe. Look, look at this."
He pulled out one of the interactive leaflets Leone had handed over earlier. He held up the front, which was full of information about Neanderthals.
"You two are bad news. You should have stayed extinct. Even Mr. Castle knows you were a mistake now. He's nearly been killed because of you two being here. But don't worry. There's a way out of this mistake. You see, what you do is, you kill this echo, and then you escape. And people will start to worry. Maybe you could smash a rock over a human's head, too. So suddenly they won't sympathize anymore. And the zone won't be the bad guy. So I'm serious. Kill, and then escape. Free. We want no more of you."
So there I was, on that dusty floor, staring up at Audrey's face on the back of the leaflet that was in Louis's hand, making her a silent promise. I had Louis's boot pressed into my stomach and the jolt club inches away from my face. And, further away, there was Zeta One pointing an antimatter positron towards me. If he fired it, I would be nothing, not even a stain on the stone floor. Louis turned away from Oregon for a second. He studied me. His eye cam made a noise, zooming in to capture my misery.
"An echo that feels fear. An echo that feels pain. I wonder what else you can feel."
I stared at him, as defiantly as I could.
"Hatred," I told him.
Louis took a deep breath. He seemed triumphant, like he'd got something he'd wanted.
"Good, good. Now, Oregon, drop that little stone. Take this rock."
Oregon dropped the blood-stained flint and took the rock. My mind was filled with information it didn't need right then. I didn't need to know that the rock was granite, composed of quartz, feldspar, and biotite materials, or that granite rock formed most of the tectonic plates in the Earth's crust. This information was not going to help me. Oregon came over to me, raised it high in the air. "I'm just a machine, an automaton, an advanced robot." I closed my eyes. "I cannot be killed because I'm not alive. I am a nothing. The world will not change without me. Pain is just an illusion. There is no such thing as pain."
You have to tell yourself such comforting lies when you're about to confront non-existence. I wondered, in that half second, if Audrey was alive or dead. And I waited for the blow. The end. The peace that only being nothing could bring. But that's not what happened. What happened was this. A thud. A tiny sound of cracking bone. Opening my eyes, I instantly realized what was going on. Oregon had smashed the rock into Louis's face, sending blood spraying everywhere. I looked at Oregon and told him and Pitu to run.
Now! Come on! You've got to get out of here!
But Oregon stood there, staring at the blood-drenched rock as Louis writhed on the ground.
Sita-wan! Sita-wan!
Louis was bellowing as he clutched his face.
Kill them!
Chapter 17. That titanium and steel hulk of a robot raised the pistol and fired, and there was a thin, quivering pulse of air and a noise like a sharp inhale, as if the enclosure itself was gasping for breath. Oregon went first. He was there, and then he was swallowed up into nothing. Gone. Not a trace.
No!
Pitu cried in an anguished howl as she ran at the robot. It was no match. She too was gone in a second. And in another second it would have been me. But I knew Zeta-1 would not kill me unless instructed by Louis. The instruction had been, kill them. But from Zeta-1's perspective, I wasn't alive any more than Zeta-1 itself was alive. I was an echo. I could only be terminated, not killed. So I kicked the jolt club out of Louis' hand and covered his mouth. His blood ran over my skin, and then he bit into my palm. He knew I could feel the pain. I dragged him forward under the illuminated gaze of Zeta-1, who kept the gun aimed at me all the time, and I pulled Louis across the enclosure, past the cave and the landscape grass and ferns towards the exit.
Command me, master,
Zeta-1 was saying.
What is my command? What is my command?
Louis screamed through my hand, but his muffled cry was not understood.
I am sorry, master, but I could not process that command. Please try again. I am sorry, master, but I could not process that command. Please try again. I am sorry, master, but I could not process that command. Please try again.
And I took Louis right out of there, out onto the path. There was a group of visitors, Chinese day trippers, all wearing identical mine wires, wondering why they couldn't see the Neanderthals. When they saw us, they screamed, but I kept moving with Louis. He struggled and squirmed like a